It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Due to the graphic nature of this couple's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of domestic violence and murder that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13. Local police took inventory of the items they found at 3347 and a half 34th Street. Suitcases packed with upscale clothing. Rings, earrings, other expensive jewelry. Scribbled poetry on random scraps of paper. A marriage proposal. A vehicle title, a guitar. A shotgun, a pistol. Four rifles, and a Browning automatic rifle. A modern and incredibly deadly piece of machinery. Two dead bodies. One at the scene, one at the hospital. Both officers of the law. They uncovered the identities of four of the occupants, Buck and Blanche, Clyde, and Bonnie. But the last piece of evidence was the most important, the cameras. Cameras with undeveloped rolls of film. When they were developed, policemen looked upon them with awe. They revealed the occupants of the house messing around like friends, smiling and joking with carefree abandon. But it was a singular subject that captured the imagination of the country. A young woman, small, fashionable, confident. She held a shotgun and a pistol. She chewed on a cigar and struck masculine, erotic poses. Her name was Bonnie Parker, and when they published the photos, she became an American legend. Hi, I'm Lainey Hobbs, and this is Crimes of Passion, a Parcast original. In the legal definition, a crime of passion is a violent crime that occurs in the throes of extreme emotion, leaving no time to reflect on the consequences. But in this show, we explore passionate crimes. How does a marriage progress from husband and wife to killer and victim, or killer and co-conspirator? If there's a thin line between love and hate, what manipulates our relationships into deadly results? This is our final episode on the notorious criminal duo, Bonnie and Clyde, who cultivated a relationship that was so passionate and dangerous, it captured the hearts of the entire country. At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information. It may just be in retrospect, but Clyde Barrow and Bonnie Parker were both intimately familiar with fate. They were well aware of the powerful arm of the law, that running from it was a fruitless exercise bound to end only in their demise. And yet, they still chose to run. Perhaps they were running from fate. Perhaps they were running to it. Either way, they were painfully aware that the world that was handed to them was not one they could live in. They were too bright and exuberant for it. They would not, could not, let their luminescence be drowned within the mundane tyranny of their poverty. It could be for this reason why, in early 1932, Bonnie chose to fully follow Clyde into his life of crime. When Clyde left prison in February 1932, he made a vow to Bonnie, to her mother, to his family, that he would give his best shot to the straight life. Unfortunately, This pitted him against a crushing social climate, especially considering his criminal record. In West Dallas, Clyde had cultivated a reputation as a thief and an easy target for police whenever they had a petty crime on their hands. Clyde found it near impossible to hold on to a job. Anytime he found a new one, Dallas police would be around to harass him. This caused any would-be employers to cut off ties before anything got overly complex. Job openings were scarce enough as it was. The full force of the Great Depression had crushed the American economy, and businesses with ample employment opportunities were few and far between. Certainly not enough to entertain the idea of taking on an ex-convict that was regularly harassed or arrested during work hours. Clyde's sister Nell tried to circumvent the constant badgering by finding him a construction job in Massachusetts. The idea was to get the troubled 22-year-old away from the natural judgment of his hometown. When he saved up enough, he could return home to open the auto repair shop he often talked about. Alas, the kid from the Southwest was never meant to last in the cold and harsh conditions of the Northeast. He quickly felt besieged by loneliness and returned home in early March of 1932. Bonnie delighted in having him home, but resented the treatment he'd received in trying to make an honest living. The two of them truly felt hopeless in the face of playing by the rules. Yes, Bonnie had a job, but still had to live with her mother. Yes, Clyde brought much of the scrutiny upon himself by breaking the law in the first place. But he only did so because the tyrannical nature of factory work assured that he would be working long, desperate hours for decades just to afford the right to feed himself. Psychologists have long studied the state of emotional well-being in regards to long-term unemployment and poverty. A 2015 Brazilian study found that people suffering from poverty and extreme poverty exhibited exaggerated traits of fatalism and pessimism. This type of fatalism in Bonnie and Clyde manifested in the sense that they believed they would never find adequate employment. As such, they looked outside of the workforce to find ways to control their own lives. They wanted desperately to escape this sense of fatalism and to bend the world around them. And if it meant their demise, so be it, as long as Clyde never had to return to prison. For Clyde, his time at Easton Prison Farm was something that would forever haunt him, both physically and mentally. His limp, caused from his missing big toe, would constantly be a reminder of his desperate act of self-mutilation and the anger he cultivated from the physical and mental abuse he endured never dissipated. In fact, it would only be exacerbated when in March of 1932, just a month after his parole, Clyde received a visit from an old friend. When Ralph Fultz saw the news of Clyde Barrow's release in an article, he immediately jumped on a train to West Dallas to reconnect with his fellow ex-convict. Fultz wanted to make sure Clyde never forgot the atrocities of prison life. He subtly reminded the young Barrow about their plan. If they ever got out of Eastham, they would find a way to enact revenge by wreaking havoc on the institution. Fultz had gotten to Barrow at just the right time. The 22-year-old was feeling particularly dejected and hateful toward the institution. A reminder of how cruel Eastham was only stirred this flame and furthered his drive to pursue his life of crime. But if they were going to stage the mass prison break they envisioned, they needed the proper tools. Big, fast cars. A large, savvy crew of criminals. Guns. Lots and lots of guns. And a boatload of cash to pay for it all. They started by recruiting Fultz's friends from his prison days. It took several unsuccessful attempts, but in March of 1932, the gang executed its first successful heist when they ripped off the First National Bank in Lawrence, Kansas. According to Fultz, it earned them about $33,000, over $500,000 today. While this clearly seems like an exaggeration on Fultz's part, it was still probably more money than Clyde had ever seen in his life at one time. Unfortunately, the crew used a significant portion of it to purchase guns from a pawnbroker. Guns that turned out to be defunct and ineffective, leaving the Barrow Gang in slightly more of a pinch than they preferred to be in. Then, for reasons not entirely understood, Bonnie got involved. On April 17, 1932, Clyde asked her to do a sort of recon mission at Easton Prison Farm, where she would inform Aubrey Scally of the plan to break him and other prisoners out. Bonnie pretended to be Scally's cousin, duped the guard, and returned with good news. Scally liked the plan. He was in. This mission fulfilled Bonnie's long love of the stage and acting, and her natural attraction to risk, danger, and adventure. She was hooked. Bonnie may have been what psychologist Marvin Zuckerman would call a sensation seeker, or, as we more colloquially call it, an adrenaline junkie. A sensation seeker constantly looks for unique experiences to stimulate adrenaline secretion without regard for social consequences. Lying and stealing are well-known behaviors that instigate this biological response. Sensation seekers are also more prone to drug and alcohol abuse, and Bonnie was a well-documented drinker. After her deception at the prison, Bonnie continued to look for these novel experiences. No longer would she be Clyde's girl alone. She was fully in on the schemes of the Barrow Gang. So, the next day, she accompanied Clyde and Fultz on a mission to Tyler, Texas, where they planned to boost the cars they would use in the prison break. The mission was a success. Clyde, Bonnie, and Fultz commandeered two large state-of-the-art vehicles, a Buick and a Ford. However, rather than regroup and think about their next move, the gang chose to improvise. On the trip out to Tyler, Clyde and Fultz had noticed a poorly guarded hardware store in Kaufman stocked with guns. They figured if they hit the store, the trip could be especially worthwhile. What they didn't account for was the night watchman, who caught Clyde playing with the padlocks in the middle of the night. He sounded the alarm, and the hunt was on. The Barrow Gang had the advantage. Clyde was an excellent driver, and their souped-up new rides were far superior to the vehicles of law enforcement. What they didn't account for was the mud. Rainy conditions left the dirt roads of the country virtually impassable, and the heavy cars quickly slowed to a stop. Adrenaline coursed through Bonnie as she exited the car and made her way through the rain. The thick slush of the road tugged at her feet as she ran, and each step felt heavier. She wasn't sure when she lost her shoes, but soon she felt the mud sucking up through her toes. She saw the farmhouse in the distance with the rest of them. Its outline was blurred in the sheet of rain. She heard the knock, the muffled voices, saw the farmer point out to his pasture. Clyde told her they were going to have to ride this one out. She didn't understand what he meant until she was on the back of a mule, arms wrapped around Clyde's waist. Unfortunately, the mules moved slower in the storm than the group did on foot, and soon they had to abandon them. For a while, the three of them moved along, but then there were only two. Fultz had disappeared. Bonnie wasn't sure when. But the echoing gunshots left little room for them to ponder where he went. Bonnie and Clyde hunkered down in an irrigation ditch, listening to the shouts of the search party. They heard more gunshots, but that could mean anything. At first, Clyde was all doom and gloom, sputtering that this might be it for the duo in between battered breaths. But then he calmed a little and crouched in front of his lover. She felt rather miserable, but still smiled up at him. They could get one of us, but they wouldn't get both. He told her he was going to find a car. He would come back for her. Then he was gone. before she really understood what he had said. She waited for hours, barefoot, clothes soaked through, her body trembling with an uncontrollable shiver. And still, there was a distant exhilaration coursing through her, a desperate fulfillment that made her feel light and easy. Even as she stood up and walked into the road, even as the town mob slapped handcuffs on her and stuck her in the back seat of the car. We'll explore the aftermath of Bonnie's arrest after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Now back to the story. On April 19, 1932, Bonnie Parker and Ralph Foltz were arrested after an attempted robbery at a hardware store in Kaufman, Texas. Both refused to identify their third accomplice, who was, of course, Clyde Barrow. Clyde tried to uphold his promise of rescuing his lover and his partner. Over the next few days, he attempted various robberies to earn the supplies he would need to break them out of prison. However, these were either botched, called off, or, in one case, involved the murder of an innocent citizen. Clyde wasn't the one to pull the trigger. In fact, he wasn't even in the room. But the wife of the deceased man identified Clyde as one of the three men present. He was now officially wanted for murder. Forced to lay low, Clyde could only listen through the grapevine as Foltz was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and he could only pray as Bonnie was brought in front of the Kaufman grand jury on June 17, 1932. It had been 2 months since Bonnie's arrest. She occupied her time by writing stories and poetry. One, in particular, caused her mother great dismay, as the subjects of the poem seemed awfully familiar. There I fell for the line of a henchman, a professional killer from Chai. I couldn't help loving him madly. For him, even now, I would die. 1 year we were desperately happy. Our ill-gotten gains, we spent free. I was taught the ways of the underworld. Jack was just like a god to me. Though the story took on some rather large exaggerations, it's clear that she was relaying her venture into the criminal world through love. Sal, the main character of the poem, laments that after taking the rap for her lover Jack, he fails to break her out and she gets 5 to 50 years in prison. However, the real Bonnie Parker was not so unlucky. In court, Bonnie alleged that she was kidnapped and forced to participate in the Kaufman robbery. It was a story she had practiced with Foltz. It worked. The grand jury ordered Bonnie to be released immediately. Her mother Emma rejoiced, believing that now was finally the time Bonnie could break free from Clyde's suffocating influence. Emma's dreams were not to be. When she was released, Bonnie went back to Clyde straight away. She moved in with him and Raymond Hamilton, another ex-convict, in Wichita Falls. Her desire to reunite so quickly with Clyde was interesting for two reasons. First, it solidified that Bonnie had little to no interest in pursuing a career as a waitress or any other profession in which her middling income would leave her relatively trapped. Second, Bonnie knew that Clyde had no intention of ever going to prison again. After failing to retain an honest job, he made the choice to fully pursue a life of crime. That choice had a singular outcome. Clyde would die. He would do everything in his power to avoid capture, and if that meant going down with guns blazing, so be it. Bonnie was well aware that Clyde felt this way. It was the reason he left her in the irrigation ditch in Kaufman. He knew she could survive a stint in jail. He could not. So when Bonnie chose to go with Clyde in 1932, she was choosing to die with him. This is how strong her love was for the well-dressed, charming 23-year-old. She would break the law, would defy and reject her mother, would sacrifice her own life, if only to live briefly with Clyde Barrow. The deal they made wasn't a deal with the devil. It was a deal with Aphrodite, with her son, Eros, the one who shoots arrows through your heart. Except these wouldn't be arrows. They would be .45-caliber bullets from automatic rifles. Clyde had already been testing out the limits of his newfound pact. In his days before prison, Clyde would always run when confronted with authority. Now, he was overtaken with an instinct to fight. A 2004 study in behavioral neuroscience led by Menno Crook, PhD, found that stress hormones in rats and aggressive behavior work together in a positive feedback loop. That is, when the stress hormone increased, aggression increased, and displaying aggressive behaviors increased the production of the stress hormone. Nothing stressed Clyde out so much as returning to prison, where he was overworked, lived in squalid conditions, and was repeatedly abused and sexually assaulted. The simple thought of returning to that environment was enough to cause Clyde to lash out. So whenever confronted by police, and thereby the possibility of arrest, Clyde began resorting to violence. This only served to snowball his aggressive tendencies whenever Clyde found himself in a jam. So in the coming months of 1932 and 1933, Clyde and the Barrow Gang were responsible for the deaths of several men. On August 5, 1932, Clyde shot Eugene Moore, an undersheriff from Stringtown, Oklahoma, in a firefight instigated by the illegal consumption of alcohol outside of a community dance. On December 25, 1932, Clyde shot Doyle Johnson in front of his family after he tried to stop Clyde from stealing his car. On January 6, 1933, Clyde shot Fort Worth deputy Malcolm Davis with a shotgun at point-blank range. Clyde began to build a reputation. He was well-dressed and put together. He carried his signature gun, a Browning automatic rifle. He drove fancy cars and often had a particular, beautiful young woman at his side. It became a trendy thing in Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico to attribute a crime to Clyde Barrow and his gang. He was a mobile outlaw. He could drive for hours on end without rest. So when simultaneous reports of robbery emerged in both Texas and Oklahoma, of course, they were attributed to the ghost bandit of the Southwest. In reality, most of these crimes were not Clyde's doing, but he did appreciate the mystique it generated. He and Bonnie started collecting the various news articles about him as souvenirs. The pair weren't just kids from the slums of Dallas anymore. They mattered. But life on the open road was not so luxurious. Clyde's publicity offered them little chance at secrecy. They often slept in the car, bathed in creeks and rivers, begged farmers for food, tended to their wounds with makeshift medical supplies. They drank bootleg moonshine as a way to pass the time and to deal with the mosquitoes and constant paranoia. But they had each other, and they were nomadic and free. The Barrow's crime spree went on the road like a traveling circus, making appearances in Indiana, Ohio, Louisiana, New Mexico, and Oklahoma. But they made it a point to be back in Texas when on March 22, 1933, Buck Barrow was released from the Texas Penitentiary in Huntsville. He reunited with his estranged wife, Blanche, and sought to convince his brother Clyde to go clean. After all, it was Buck who got him into the life of crime in the first place. Unfortunately, just the opposite happened. When Bonnie and Clyde came to visit Buck, they slowly worked at his inhibitions until Buck and Blanche agreed to take a vacation to Joplin, Missouri. So in early April, the five-man crew, including the two couples and a teenager named W.D. Jones, rented a house at 3347 and a half 34th Street and went on what they dubbed a vacation. And for a time, it was. Prohibition had just been lifted on beer, and they drank and played cards, keeping late hours. Blanche felt uncomfortable with Clyde's raucous lifestyle, but she loved Buck dearly and trusted him to remain level-headed when it came to his brother. Unfortunately, none of them would have that chance. Joplin was relatively well-known for bootleggers during the Prohibition era, and the neighborhood took note of the strange occupants at 3347 and a half 34th Street. They were always up until the wee hours of the morning making noise. They often kept nice vehicles in their driveway that seemingly manifested out of nowhere. One night, some would swear that a gunshot went off in the house. It was enough to warrant a small task force. They were used to dealing with alcohol dealers. A fine, a light prison sentence, then everyone washed their hands and went back to work. On April 13, 1933, local policemen Tom DeGraff and Harry McGinnis led the raid with Highway Patrolman G.B. Collar and W.E. Grammer, along with County Constable Wes Harriman. They expected a quick in-and-out job. They brought along their light pistols in case things got a little too rowdy. The five-man law enforcement crew pulled up to the house just as Clyde Barrow and W.D. Jones were shutting the garage. Wes Harriman leapt from the squad cars, drew his gun, and attempted to get inside the closing door. Clyde responded with a blast from his shotgun. The shot struck Harriman in the neck. He fell to the ground and bled to death as chaos erupted around him. Blanche Barrow was in the kitchen when she heard what sounded like distant gunshots. She didn't think much of it until her husband, Buck, came bounding up the stairs. He shouted that the cops were there. It was time to leave, immediately. Before she could stop him, Buck took off back down the stairs toward the sound of the gunfire. Disoriented, Bonnie made her way to her room. Her purse. She needed her purse. Her whole life was in there. She started down the hall, but then there was W.D., doubled over and clutching at an open bullet wound in his side. He nearly toppled over, but Blanche was able to hold him up. The gunshots finally quit, and Blanche followed the sounds of Clyde's beckoning shouts, supporting W.D., the whole way to the garage. When she got to the scene of the carnage, she took brief note of the mangled bodies in the driveway and then moved to help Clyde push the police car out of the way. Blanche felt delirious. There was blood everywhere. The garage door was torn to shreds. W.D. was moaning about his death, and two obliterated police officers lay stock still in pools of their own blood. Clyde shouted to get in the Ford V8. Blanche obeyed. Really, there was nothing for her to do but obey. With Clyde at the wheel, the V8 pulled into the street and took off down the road. Not a single shot was fired after them. Coming up, the strange and jarring impact of the raid in Joplin. Now, the conclusion of the story. The raid of the Barrow Gang in Joplin, Missouri, left two officers of the law dead, County Constable Wes Harriman and Joplin policeman Harry McGinnis. Authorities were outraged, but it did not take them long to find who was responsible. The purse Blanche left behind contained her divorce papers from her previous marriage and her marriage license to Buck Barrow. From Buck, police inferred Clyde, and from Clyde, they inferred Bonnie. W.D. Jones was never officially identified, even though he appeared in the most important piece of evidence found at the scene. Investigators found a camera and several rolls of film at the Joplin house. When they were developed, they revealed the five members of the Barrow gang, mostly playing jokes and having fun. The pictures that stood out the most, however, featured Bonnie Parker. In one photograph, she's holding up Clyde with a shotgun while the pair share a smile. In a second, they ostentatiously kiss as though in the movies. And then there is one that features Bonnie with her leg lifted seductively on a car's hood. Note that this type of pose was risque for the time period. With one hand, she totes a handgun. In her lips rests a cigar. And on her face rests a scowl. Despite these more masculine props, Bonnie still wears her clothes and style with grace. She is relatively clean for her lifestyle. Her fashion is intentional and realized, and despite her stern expression, there is something jovial and carefree about what she is doing. She embodies both the masculine and the feminine all at once, blurring the lines of an incredibly divisive world. So it's no wonder that when the police released the series of photographs to the press in the hope of getting leads, it didn't have the exact desired effect. The photo spread like wildfire, and the legend of Bonnie and Clyde was seemingly born overnight.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
The crime duos certainly weren't the first to make waves in headlines. They followed John Dillinger, Pretty Boy Floyd, Ma Barker, all renegades, all household names. And even they were spiritual descendants of Jesse James, Wild Bill Hickok, and the other infamous outlaws of the 19th century. The point is, outlaws were not a new concept. There had even been women outlaws, but outlaws that were in love, that was something new. That was something that dipped further into the waters of the forbidden, causing a deliciously satisfying shiver to run down the spine of America. A 2007 study by several professors from the University of Leicester found that there was a link between celebrity worship and a search for personal identity. During Bonnie and Clyde's time, most American citizens were swallowed by the beast of the Great Depression. While Franklin Roosevelt had recently been elected and was beginning to stabilize the economy, it would still take years for this to be realized. The Dust Bowl in the plains of the Southwest cast a shadow over the agricultural community and sent shockwaves of illness throughout the territory. Workers were angry and on strike. Poverty seemed shackling and never-ending, and to the common man, there was little hope on the horizon. Personal identity was a completely foreign concept to the majority. Celebrities in films were much more mythical creatures than they are today, distant and completely unrelatable. But Bonnie and Clyde were just like everyone else. Once lost in the impoverished masses, they were able to take fate into their own hands, to discover love and life in the tumultuous rubble of the Great Depression. They were the outlaw lovers, the pair that said no to fate and yes to their individuality. The country was desperate, and Bonnie and Clyde, with their pictures toting wide smiles and guns and jokes, were not. And so the common people of the Depression era found an identity in rebels like the outlaw duo. It allowed people for a time to live in the fantasy that they too could reject the law. Never mind that the criminal duo's day-to-day existence was most likely worse than the average citizen. Never mind that they were probably more focused on their own survival than anything else. They had chosen their life, and that was simply a luxury few could afford. For Bonnie and Clyde, while they relished in their fame, it became more of an obstacle than anything else. They needed to lay low, pay attention to anyone who looked at them for too long, be careful about saying their real names out loud. The release of the pictures and subsequent explosion of Bonnie and Clyde fever in 1933 seems to mark the beginning of the couple's tragic downfall. It all started in Wellington, Texas on June 10, 1933, when Clyde was driving fast as he always did, except he was driving too fast to see a sign that warned the bridge ahead was under construction. The car blew through the barrier and plummeted toward the dry riverbed below. The vehicle rolled over several times. Fortunately, several local farmers witnessed the accident and rushed over to pry open the jammed doors. They were able to free W.D. Jones and Clyde, who both sustained injuries, but were relatively okay. But there was still one person left, almost jammed in the wreckage of the car. When they finally did reach Bonnie, they were met with a gruesome sight. Scalding battery acid from the crushed engine had splashed onto Bonnie's leg, and it was eating away at her flesh and tissue. It had already made its way to her bone. The farmers were able to get Bonnie back to their house, where they applied baking soda as a way to neutralize the acid. Bonnie was allowed to rest for a time, but after Clyde refused a doctor, the farmers realized the group was trouble, and they contacted the police. After only a brief spot of time to heal their wounds, the gang was forced to hit the road again. Without appropriate treatment, Bonnie was never able to walk properly again. Strangely, this made her all the more like Clyde, who carried a limp ever since he chopped off his own big toe. Now, the couple that had shared ambitions, adventure, and a taste for the arts also shared a defining limp. The next tragedy struck in late July of 1933. After a series of shootouts with law enforcement, Buck Barrow was mortally wounded. He died on July 29, 1933. As a result of the same shootouts, Blanche Barrow was taken into custody and questioned about her time with the Barrow gang. J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the Bureau of Investigation, even visited her personally to try his hand at gleaning information as to the whereabouts of Bonnie and Clyde. Hoover had taken on the problem of Depression-era gangsters, the same gangsters that populated newspaper headlines daily. Bonnie and Clyde's fame and popularity made them an obvious target for J. Edgar Hoover's assault. Then, in October of 1933, Bonnie lost her niece and nephew to an unexplained illness. She was devastated. But when Emma Parker tried to make one final plea for Bonnie to leave Clyde, she was bluntly rejected. By the end of 1933, doom was written on the wall for the Barrow gang. They were wanted in multiple states and were easily recognized. Bonnie was crippled. Buck was dead. Blanche was in prison. WD and many of the other past gang members were either arrested or in prison. Bonnie had experienced a great family tragedy, and Kumi Barrow, Clyde's mother, was so certain of his imminent death that she had yet to get Buck a gravestone. When Clyde died soon, she could save money by having one for both of them. But despite the mounting pressure, there was still one thing left to do. In the dim moonlight of January 13, 1934, Bonnie and Clyde stood leaning against their newest Ford V8. Overlooking the fence perimeter of the Eastham Prison Farm, Clyde did not feel what he thought he would feel. In fact, he didn't feel much of anything. All he could see was the faint shadows of untamed brush, waiting to be cleared and worked by the inmate work crews. Then Jimmy Mullins, an ex-convict himself, and Floyd Hamilton, older brother of Raymond Hamilton, emerged from the thicket with a hurried gait. "It's done," they told Clyde. Aubrey Scally would have no trouble getting the guns on Monday. Scally, the man who took the fall for the murder of Ed Crowder, was a veteran of Eastham and therefore could afford certain luxuries. One of those luxuries was the freedom to move about the grounds, to find the two Colt 45 automatics Mullins and Hamilton planted on the property. They would give the guns to two of the four men they were intending to break out. Henry Methven, Joe Palmer, and Raymond Hamilton were all old friends of Barrow's. Hilton Bigby was involved in the plan as a favor to Ralph Foltz. It was out of Clyde's hands now. All he had to do was wait. On Tuesday, January 16th, Clyde leaned against the car with the same carefree posture as before. But beneath the surface, he felt exhausted. His muscles ached from several nights camped out in his vehicle. He'd spent his days constantly checking his rearview mirror for cop cars. Bonnie's limp was so bad he often had to carry her around. But he was here, and he would go through with this job, almost as a duty more than a desire. He had made that pact with Foltz years ago. He would uphold it now, for a strange code of honor. And in some way, he would instigate the prison break simply because he could. He held a Browning automatic rifle with armor-piercing bullets. The gun had become familiar to him now, its weight reassuring. Bonnie stayed in the car, something she was growing used to with her bum leg. Clyde blew her a kiss and made his way to a hidden creek near the fence line where he crouched and listened. When he heard the first shots, he stood up, purposely aiming over the heads of the inmates. Everyone, prisoners and guards alike, hit the ground to avoid the hail of bullets. Everyone, except those privy to the plan. Henry Methven, Hilton Bigby, Raymond Hamilton, and Joel Palmer made a break for the fence line. They followed the sound of Bonnie honking the Ford V8's horn, jumped in, and tore off down the dirt road. After nearly 3 years, Clyde had finally staged the prison escape he dreamt of. But it wasn't to last. Hamilton, Bigby, and Palmer were caught quickly and reincarcerated. Methven joined up with Bonnie and Clyde, but would soon turn against his liberators. Though the success of the prison break did not last, the victory was psychological. The Texas prison system's general manager, Lee Simmons, was furious. Simmons took the issue of Bonnie and Clyde into his own hands. He called upon famed Texas Ranger, Frank Hamer, a ruthless and meticulous hunter who had killed dozens of criminals over the course of his career. Hamer gave the order, "I want you to put Clyde and Bonnie on the spot and then shoot everyone in sight." It was never meant to be an investigation. It was an execution from the outset. In some ways, Bonnie and Clyde knew the end was near, but it seems they had both accepted it. Bonnie ended a poem she wrote around April of 1934 with the lines, "They don't think they're too smart or desperate. They know that the law always wins. They've been shot at before, but they do not ignore that death is the wages of sin. Someday they'll go down together. They'll bury them side by side. To few, it'll be grief. To the law, a relief. But it's death for Bonnie and Clyde." Frank Hamer was methodical in tracking Bonnie and Clyde. He found a pattern in their movements. They moved in a circle around the Southwest, often driving along state lines to avoid direct border crossing, which was subject to official scrutiny. After only a few months, he pinpointed a series of several robberies that ended in Bienville Parish, Louisiana, the hometown of Henry Methven's parents. Hamer was able to reach out to Methven through the local sheriff, who gave him a deal, a full pardon, in exchange for Bonnie and Clyde. So on May 23, 1934, five heavily armed officers waited in the brush on Highway 154. They waited for the sounds of a car driving too fast. the sounds of a car that could only be driven by Clyde Barrow. When it came, Frank Hamer gave the signal. The five officers stood up and unloaded on the Ford V8. Clyde was hit first. Bonnie screamed briefly. Then, silence. The saga of Bonnie and Clyde ended with each of their corpses riddled with 25 bullet holes. By the time they passed, the world was changing. FDR's New Deal was beginning to take effect, healing the banking system and those most harshly hit by the Dust Bowl. Prohibition was slowly being repealed. Hitler was chancellor in Germany and would soon become Führer. The American people would soon have an enemy much worse than their own government. They did not need outlaws anymore. The renegades who stood up to social injustice, whose stories gave relief to those suffering. So no one gave too much of a fuss when J. Edgar Hoover's program slowly eradicated the public enemy era. But the influence of Bonnie and Clyde lingered. Their story was almost a legend in its own time and became even more so as the years and decades passed. They are familiar to all of us, and when we hear their names together, it ignites an uncontrolled sensation, a feeling of partnership, of communication, of the rebellious spirit. It's true that the lives of Bonnie and Clyde were not as glamorous as pop culture makes them out to be. But perhaps that is because the world has forgotten that at the heart of their story lies something we all understand, something universal. Theirs was a quest for choice, a quest for survival, a quest for love. Thanks again for tuning in to Crimes of Passion. We will be back Wednesday with a new episode. For more information on Bonnie and Clyde, amongst the many sources we used, we found Go Down Together, The True Untold Story of Bonnie and Clyde by Jeff Quinn, extremely helpful to our research. You can find more episodes of Crimes of Passion, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or your favorite podcast directory. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time when true love meets true crime. Crimes of Passion was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, with sound design by Carrie Murphy. Production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Crimes of Passion was written by Drew Cole. I'm Lainey Hobbs.